You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. Today I have with me, well, what should I call you? AKA Profiles or...
Yeah, you know, like on my username for Nostra, I'm like, well, I'm kind of using this for my personal correspondence, but I'm also using it to talk about the product. So my name is Neil, and I'm the founder of akaprofiles.com.
Awesome. So yeah, Neil reached out to me, I don't know, a while ago, maybe like October of last year or something like that, with some questions, wanted to talk about a few different topics that we're going to touch on in this episode. And I haven't talked to him since then, but, I checked out his project, again, recently and was reminded. I think Neil's got some good things to think about that other people aren't necessarily focusing on right now. So I wanted to have a conversation about some of this, which is also close to my heart. But before we get into it, Neil, could you like quickly introduce yourself, your Nostra background and like what you're currently working on and what you're kind of focused on right now?
Yeah, sure. So in a nutshell, the first half of my career was as a software developer. Then I went back to school, did my MBA, and the last almost 10 years now was in product management. I know software developers love product managers.
Oh, yes.
But then, you know, I decided, you know, I really wanted to do something that I was passionate about. I wanted a product that, you know, I actually owned instead of working on other people's stuff. So I had an idea around decentralized identity. That's how I stumbled into the Nostra space, because I was really dissatisfied with how difficult it was to implement some of the existing W3 standards for decentralized identity. And I had to teach myself how to program again, because, you know, if you haven't programmed for like 10 years, a lot of the stuff changes. So yeah, so it's been an interesting journey for sure.
Yeah, that's true. My dad's an old school Microsoft programmer, so he helped write Windows NT and C. And then he retired like 10 years ago, and he picked up web technology a few years ago. And he's doing well at like keeping up with the conventions. But still, I'm like, Dad, like you just got to use a bundler, you got to use a framework. And he's like, No, I can do it without. So, tell me a little bit about the decentralized identity stuff. Is this the DIDS spec that you attempted to integrate? Have you worked with like Blue Sky or Farcaster or anything like that before you came over to Nostra?
No, I was working with DIDS and verifiable credentials. I'm kind of a quick and dirty programmer, so if somebody has a framework in place, I'll use that. So a lot of those, like Microsoft's platform, a lot of them are... It's not technically necessary, but they're pretty much all backed by a blockchain as the data store. And then even, so it's interesting, so DIDS as well as like the verifiable credential spec, right? So one, I was frustrated in how difficult it was just to take the first step, which is just to create a DID, right? Because the DID specification itself is pretty heavy. And even if you need a framework or a library, you still also need permission to write to the blockchain. So immediately I was like, well, this seems like a heavier lift than it necessarily needs to be. And then in the verifiable credential space, usually the diagram has like four boxes. You've got the holder, the issuer, the verifier, and then there's one box, which nobody really talks about very much, but it's like the verifiable data registry, and everything points to the verifiable data registry. It's like, well, that's pretty centralized. So I was like, okay, there's got to be a better way of do this, because, you know, these standards have been around for a long time. They've had a lot of support, but still no real mass adoption outside of like institutions of this. And, you know, identity is a passion of mine. So I thought, you know what, let's teach myself how to program again. Let's play around and think Nostra and see what's possible.
Yeah, I love one of the phrases that you used. You need permission to write to the blockchain.
Well, you do, right?
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's that's almost, you know, defeats the purpose of a lot of, well, I mean, you know, Bitcoin, you don't need permission.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
And to have permission when it's supposed to be a decentralized thing. Obviously, that's not the direction that all blockchains have gone in. Since then, but I think that is so good, such a good illustration of the problem of the centralization of that registry, basically. But Yeah. So what has made you, you said that identity is a passion of yours. What kind of, what has gotten you interested in identity, and what sort of problems downstream of that are you hoping to solve?
Yeah. So I worked for a few years for a company who does traditional KYC, so know your customer. And their main product is basically an API gateway where it makes it easy for their customers to call one API with a bunch of PII information. And then it, through configuration, it farms it out to, you know, one, two, three, four of hundreds of different data sources that take that information, say, do I have a historical record that matches it? You know, it's not a made up name or address. And then the data points you pass in, like name, address, date of birth, those are the three most common. Do they correlate to the same individual? Do I have a record that has like all three, right? So one of the interesting things working on that, what I realized is a lot of those historical data stores that you're checking against were often data that was just a byproduct, like of another process, right? Like, you know, you you registered to vote, you applied for a credit card, a driver's license, a postpaid, a mobile phone number, right? It wasn't really, you know, that information wasn't collected necessarily for the purpose of KYC. It just happened to exist and people basically commoditized it, right? Monetized it. And yes, if you read like the fine print on screens as you're submitting information, it'll say this information is sent to third parties for verification. But, you know, for the average person, all of this is happening behind the scenes, which is, you know, not great. I think, like, if you're a technical person, it's not great because you can understand how that information can be abused, right? So that was really interesting. And then the other problem is, depending on the data source, sometimes that information is relatively up to date, but sometimes it can be months or even years, like, out of date. So sorry, I tend to ramble a little bit. I get excited about this stuff. But if you look at it as a whole, it's okay. We're trying to verify something about somebody. Some of these data sources are out of date, and the data being used is a byproduct of something else. So I started thinking, well, hold on. Like the apps we use today, the social media apps, you know, any online gaming account, anything like that, that have way more data about us, and it's 100% up to date than these sources. But a lot of it's not necessarily like PII data. But all of this exists out there, right? So what does it look like if you have like a decentralized identity solution, so the user has full control over all of the data that's, you know, attached to them, but pulled from all of these sort of modern sources? And that was like the start of the thought experiment and the, like, the experimentation process.
Nice. So yeah, like, just to recap the problem, basically, like, all these companies are not only have a lot of data and share it with one another, leaking a lot of information about you to people who don't necessarily need to know it, but a lot of that data is also out of date, and keeping that up to date is basically an impossible task. Is that kind of like a good summary of the problem?
Yeah, and to give a little more insight into it, the people who are the hardest to verify are people who are younger. They haven't had as many life events, you know, registrations to generate that data, or people in developing countries. That data may exist, but they may not. No one has necessarily used the technology to make it available as an API for people to use as verification information. So it's interesting because when a user is trying to do something, like, let's say you're applying to become a seller on a marketplace, or, you know, you're applying for a mobile phone postpaid plan, whatever it is, if they can't verify your information, you're locked out. You're locked out of a big part of the digital products and services. So sorry, that's rambling a little bit. It's not the problem I'm actually solving, but just a little more, you know, a little more detail around a problem that, you know, a lot of people don't know about.
So you know, we're looking at kind of a legacy system for identity and how it works in the real world and the problems with that that could be solved. What's kind of like your final vision for, well, maybe not final, but like your vision for what the next step is into the future as far as digital identity goes? Are you thinking that, you know, you want to enable pseudonyms, or are you just looking to kind of pragmatically solve the existing problems within the current system?
So what I really want to have is a decentralized identity solution that has a chance of actually reaching mass adoption, right? So there are three things that go along with that. One, it has to be really easy for developers to implement. Like, we want the lowest bar possible. And then two, there has to be the least amount of friction possible for anyone to be able to issue credentials, which is also a difficult task, right? So when we talk about, do I focus on actual PII and KYC, or do I focus on, pseudonym or NIM data? I chose pseudonym data because as soon as you have to take proper security measures to protect actual PII, so someone's actual name, their actual address, their actual phone number, it makes the problem space like way, way harder, because now you have to have encryption, you have to have a lot of access permissions. It gets like ugly really quickly. And then the terms of being an issuer, ideally anybody who owns a community or is part of a community, even if they're non-technical, they should be able to very easily create a badge that identifies as someone as part of their group or community and be able to have those badges issued to the people without having to understand anything about decentralized identity. So that's like I would say that's like the medium-term goal. And then the long-term goal, once enough information exists, is to be able to have the idea of an identity processor for decentralized identity, where, like, how PayPal is like a financial transaction processor, right? It verifies the funds on both sides, vouches for it, and allows the transaction to go through. An identity processor in the decentralized space is the same idea, but instead of verifying funds, you're actually verifying any like reputational information that you need to make sure that this is a connection that's valuable to both parties. So that's an interesting problem because I don't think anyone's really, thought about that before.
So, I guess one question I have is like, what does this have to do with Web of Trust? Because like, basically the idea behind identity verification is to have a way of figuring out whether a person is trusted for a given role. Whether it's to get a loan or to get access to a community or whatever it might be. Is this a substitute for Web of Trust? Is it a way of bootstrapping into a Web of Trust kind of structure? How do you see that?
I think maybe the okay, let's set aside all the stuff in the traditional like KYC space, because one, there's existing solutions for that, and then two, like I said, the first step I want it to be as easy to adopt as possible, and I don't want to have to deal with like securing actual PII. So maybe a good example would be you're trying to do what's the term? Like an enrollment check for anybody who wants to be a member of your group or community, right? So, by definition, a community is a set of people where it's not completely public, it's not completely private, but there are some attributes about a person that makes them a good fit for a community, right? So, and a community can be anything from, a group of people with a common interest to like a religious group to, people who follow a certain social media channel, any, group of people that have like common attributes. So we've all seen problems where a community starts great, you have a lot of like-minded people, but then you have a bunch of people who come in who start spamming negative comments. So then the moderator or the community owner is then forced to have some type of like check before to check to make sure someone's actually, going to be a good member of the community before they join, right? So you're talking about, in sort of higher level terms, you're talking about some type of access control based off of some information attribute related to a person. I'll just pause here. Web of Trust is interesting. Most of the time I've heard about it discussed within the Nostr space, it's really trying to figure out what content that you're displaying. So then we see that there's some kind of relationship between the idea of attributes related to a person that are hopefully verifiable, and then determining how people are connected together. So when we're talking about a feed, we're talking about when someone's content, you know, is becomes visible or is promoted to the other person. So that's sort of the space I've been working in.
Yeah, definitely. And like there's different parts of Web of Trust where like some of it is for just basic spam control, like, you know, this many people that you follow also follow this person. This is a very naive version, but other people are working on sort of I always call it vectorized, but it's not really the right word, but context dependent attestations of trust. And so, like, you know, for example, this person knows a lot about economics. So, you know, I can recommend that person strongly to anyone who has me in their web of trust. And like, it seems like, you know, to start with, what we have is basically follows, your follow graph. And that's very naive. And it's not very substantial. It's just like, you know, I follow that person. And so it forms this really weak attestation. And in a sense, that's identity verification, where you say, like, yeah, this person's followed by 30 people, and so that I follow, and so I have some level of idea that they're legitimate. But obviously, it's neither bulletproof or very specific. And then on the other side of things, you've got these really specific things, like I think last time we talked, you were talking about using badges to represent certain attestations. Is that kind of the direction that you've gone, like? You know, this person paid me 20,000 sats. I issued them a badge, and all the badge says is they paid me 20,000 sats. But like, that is a verification of a certain like durability and level of like semantics.
Yeah. So I based everything off of NIP 58, right? So NIP 58, you know, it's called badges. And then there's three events defined within that NIP. There's like the badge definition, which the issuer publishes that defines the badge, like the image, the title, the description. Then there's the badge award, which is when the issuer is basically publishing events saying this badge is awarded to this public key. And then there's the, I always forget if it's badges profile or profile badges event, where the recipient of the badge then publishes the event to add it to their profile. So I wanted to stay obviously compatible with Nostr. So I've been building off the badges, but I've added some additional tags. I'm not repurposing tags. I'm just adding additional tags to enable some additional functionality. So that's like from the Nostr point of view. And then the first thing I did after doing that is I created a not a bot badge. And part of what AKA Profiles does to reduce the amount of code anybody has to write in terms of issuing badges is it has like a badge user workflow. So once you configure your badge, then you can direct the user to the badge award page, where the user can then take some type of action to prove their eligibility for the badge. So the first one I wrote was a not a bot badge, which basically when you go to the badge link, it displays the badge. When you click apply, it redirects to the badge awards page, which is really just a very simple Google CAPTCHA. If you pass the CAPTCHA, replies back to AKA Profiles that, yep, this person is eligible for the badge. And then the platform itself takes care of the actual publishing and issuing of the badge events.
Cool. So leaving aside a lot of other concerns right now, just like this really simple example seems to me to be very powerful. Like, you know, Cloudflare is always asking me to prove whether I'm human before I move on to a site. If I had that badge awarded to me, is that something that I could, you know, flash and basically get access to Cloudflare without having to fill in CAPTCHAs all the time?
Yeah, that's the idea. And of course, anyone familiar with Noster is familiar. You know how you like, regardless of which client you use, when you log in with your Noster key, your same profile is shown, right? The same username, the same image avatar. The idea is that with badges, that also, because it's associated with your public key, it also becomes available and transferable to all of the different apps that you use. So, you know, as an example, if you have a client Noster app and you have a database that stores information, you know, that related to the user that your application needs, but doesn't necessarily have to be published to a relay, you could very easily say, okay, before I create this person, like a new account for my client, let's check to see if they have a Notabot badge already issued by AK Profiles. If they do, great, I don't even have to like interrupt the onboarding user flow. If they don't, I can just redirect, just put a link for the user on my screen saying, hey, before you continue, please like prove you're not a robot. Redirects to AKA Profiles, they go through the badge, they get it, redirects back to your app, and then you're good to go. So then as the client developer, you didn't actually have to implement anything. You just like reused a public badge that's available to everybody.
Yeah, so why hasn't this kind of thing been done before? Why is Cloudflare and Google make people fill in captures all the time? Is it because of the barriers to entry to the DID stuff that you were talking about? Or like, are there some major trade-offs? I can think of a few, but I want to hear what's on the forefront of your mind.
Yeah, I don't know for sure. You know, I'm not the world's like most incredible technologist person, but I think the technology has existed for a long time to be able to do this. So then, you know, it's a question of incentive. And, you know, being a little bit pessimistic, I would say that whether it's your Facebook ID or your Google ID or Apple ID, I think these companies generally want to keep you within their own ecosystem. So, you know, as long as, let's say Google, for example, as long as their apps can do everything they need to do based off of your Google profile, then, you know, why would they bother try to make that available to other people? In fact, they do the opposite. It's like, no, we're at least like signing with Google, so even more people just have an account with Google, right? So
it is really interesting that walled garden effect. I feel like the greediness with which these companies approach the data that they've hoarded is almost like unreflective. Like, I'm sure people have thought about it, but these huge companies, they see data as an asset, and so they're not really willing to share it, even if it would be to their advantage. And like, obviously, as Noster grows and if Noster succeeds, these walled gardens have sowed the seeds of their own demise by failing to interoperate with each other. Because, I mean, the lock-in is already so high for Gmail and their suite of services and Facebook and their suite of services. And if Google and Facebook talked to each other and made those services interoperable, and they're not really competitors, if they cooperated, that moat would just grow exponentially. And it's really interesting that they have not done it. I don't know why that might be, and I probably shouldn't speculate, but it is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to break it down into the different companies, what their goals are, what their sources of revenue are. Like, being like an old school programmer, like I'm so old that when you would develop on the Microsoft platform, you'd get an MSDN subscription and they'd literally ship you like a folder full of CDs that you could use to install their product, right? And for the longest time, like developing in Microsoft was a very closed ecosystem. And then they realized that people were building a bunch of cool new stuff outside of their ecosystem because technology moves so fast, they can't be on top of everything. And that was like a huge surprise to me. Like, I use, Visual Studio Code, the free one. And that you don't have to use any Microsoft technology if you don't want to. Well, before, if you wanted to write anything that, you know, worked with Microsoft, you'd have to buy their I forget the name of it, but their code editor, and it only worked within the Microsoft ecosystem. So, in that particular case, you can see a company understanding that they need to plug into an ecosystem in terms of supporting developers. But on the flip side, when you have companies whose revenue models are dependent on having data that nobody else has, primarily social media applications where doing targeted customer advertising is really their main source of revenue, you can see why they'd be loath to give that up. And, we see that as well in terms of when a user uses OAuth to allow another application access to that account, at least I'm seeing a lot of the data that can be returned gets less and less. You'll go through the documentation, is like, oh, this field's deprecated. This field is deprecated. It's like, okay, they're obviously trying to restrict how much information or a person can flow out, even though that information belongs to that person and they've used OAuth to prove that they actually want to get the data out. So it's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And to go back to my example, like I said that Google and Facebook aren't really competitors, but they actually are. Like, they don't look like competitors, but they're both advertising companies. And so, yeah, that data that they hoard allows them to target people a lot more effectively. And so it would make sense that they wouldn't want to share anything that gives the other side an edge. So the incentives are such that, their interoperability is discouraged. And I wonder if we'll get there with Nostr, but obviously Nostr is designed to be a little bit more user-centric in the sense that users are the ones in control of the software that they're using and the data that they're sharing.
Yeah.
So one other downside to this system, just going back to the Cloudflare example, is privacy related, which is ironic because badges and attestations from a given identity provider are sort of designed to hide sensitive information. So, if you have a PII related identity provider and you send them your bank account information and you send them your social security card or whatever, and then they can attest to the rest of the world that you are who you say you are without having to share any of your information with everyone else. That's great because that reduces the number of people who have access to your data and the number of databases that can potentially be hacked to leak your data. But at the same time, that identity provider gets put into the loop whenever there is a request for your data. So they can know if you're applying for a loan or whatever it might be because the bank goes to this identity provider. And then you have something kind of the opposite with badges, where if you have a provider like Cloudflare that hosts, whatever percent of the internet, they now can track you because you're presenting that badge that's attached to your public key. And if you have any extra information with that goes along with that public key, they now know who you are. You could, of course, earn the badge and attach the badge to a throwaway public key that is just for that one badge, but it still allows companies to track you across the internet whenever you do present that badge. What are you thinking about those two different problems and any other privacy problems?
Yeah, so I named the product AKA Profiles for a reason. Like, AKA is the acronym for also known as, right? So, there's a lot of cases where you don't need to know my actual name and address. You just need some kind of identifier for me, right? So AKA, and then profiles is the part that you were talking about where it's like, okay, you as an individual person can have multiple profiles and you can decide, what information is attached to which profile. Even within the Nostr community, we have some people who are very comfortable with being public, even with their actual identity, while we have other people who are extremely sensitive to that and want to remain as anonymous as possible, right? So for the people who really don't care that much about privacy, they can have just one profile and have everything associated with it. And I don't care. But then for the people who are security conscious, you could literally have a different profile for every single badge that you accept. So nobody can correlate it together, right?
And then
for the second part, there's this traditional trade-off that we've always had within application development, which is like the trade-off between convenience and security and privacy, which is, yes, you can keep a lot of information very private and secure, but then if you ask a user every time before that information can be accessed, it creates a horrible user experience. So, in Noster, we see that where if you're using a Noster extension and you tell it, okay, only share or assign this bit once and prompt me next time, it doesn't take very long until you've answered that prompt 12 times within a few minutes. Eventually, yeah. You just say, now just trust this application. This is crazy, right? So,
especially as clients get more feature rich, ask for more permissions. I was playing with Amber the other day, doing an integration with it. I ended up not integrating Amber using the web intent stuff, but just using the bunker functionality. But yeah, like Coracle downloads all your direct messages and decrypts them in the background so that they're available to you when you go to the messages tab. But what that means is you have to answer 150 decryption requests before you can even start to use the software. So kind of infeasible.
Just as a shout out, my favorite new feature within Coracle is the custom feeds. Like, that thing is so cool. Like, the first thing I did was, okay, I'm going to create myself a custom feed. I'm only going to look for kind 8 events, which is the badge award event, and let's see how it works. And yeah, then it's okay, now I could specify the publisher as well. So I can use that feature not just for content, but even testing. I love that feature in Coracle.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm really excited about it. I need to pump my bags a little bit better and publicize it, because I do think it's a game changer, but I'm glad that someone's getting some use out of it.
Yeah, this is I'm trying not to get too distracted, because there's always a million things I want to do, but ideally I'd want to do what's the data vending machine? What is it called? DVMs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to write a DVM that would pull, based off of your badges, pull kind one notes just from people who have the same badges as you. It just as an experiment. I thought that'd be really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to see something like that. There's so much you can do with the custom feeds. Someone made a feed that basically pulls likes or reactions from people that you follow, and Coracle is set up so that when that happens, it shows the original note rather than the reaction.
Yeah.
And it just it worked seamlessly. I didn't think about it. Someone else provided it. And then with DVMs, you get a complete open-ended option. So yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of exploration to be done with that. But back to the rotating public, or not rotating, but kind of your different public keys that with different badges to reduce the scope of, correlating identity between different badges. What comes to mind is basically Tor circuits, right? So and this is true of regular ClearNet access as well. If you visit a bunch of different sites, you're sharing your IP address with those sites. And then if those sites collude, they can track you across all those different sites. They can see you Google something, and then you shop for something. And
it's called third-party cookies.
Yeah, exactly. So, but you have that on Tor as well. So if you're using Tor and you visit multiple sites with the same Tor circuit, that actually does leak a little bit of information, not about you necessarily, but it allows people to correlate your session. And so if your session goes to the right places, people can actually de-anonymize your Tor session. And so that's why the Tor browser has that little button that says, rotate circuit or refresh circuit or whatever it is. And when you refresh the circuit, you close your session and open it up again. And that allows you to continue browsing, but disassociate your new session from the previous one.
Yeah.
With public keys, and people talk about having public keys replace IP addresses for how we connect to each other on the internet. And I think that's a great idea, because public keys are not, they're a level higher. They're not, you're not addressing the physical device or the virtual device that's on the network, on the IP layer, and the DNS layer, but you're actually talking on more of a semantic sort of application layer. And that's really helpful, but currently private and public keys aren't rotatable. So you don't have that session refresh sort of setting, unless you do it manually, right? But you can't sort of rotate your key across multiple sessions without losing your identity, which I guess is fine. Like if you're refreshing your circuit, you do want to completely disassociate. But I don't know. It's kind of interesting when you share this information with other parties, you're potentially revealing more to them than if you just gave them the information in the first place, right? Like if all they want to know is that you're like above 18 or something like that, that's less than telling them, I have this badge that says I'm above 18, but it's associated with my use of all these other 18 plus services. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, if we think about, you know, how it happens in the physical world, sometimes you change address, sometimes you change your phone number, and then you give the new number or the new address to only people that you want to have like the new address, right? So if I'm thinking about the Nostr space, I know a lot of people have done a lot of interesting technology to say, okay, this is the root key, and from that root key you can derive a bunch of different private keys, blah blah blah. But does it really have to be that complicated? Like, can't I just create a new public key and then only tell the people that I want to know that these two keys are related, that this is my new public key, and then that's it, right?
Yeah, that is interesting. Allowing people to correlate your identity across multiple sessions, but selectively by just encrypting that connection. That is interesting. I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah.
So when you're dealing with this private data, how do you kind of imagine managing it? Do you encrypt it and store it on a relay? Do you keep it elsewhere? Do you have a special relay that's private? And how do you deal with key compromise, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I haven't implemented it because I'm worried about it. I want to think about it a little bit more. But, you know, my gut feeling is the Nostr protocol itself was specifically made for the publishing of information widely, right? Like, you know, the default spec, like an event doesn't even have to have a tag saying who this is meant to go to. The fundamental protocol is broadcast, and then you can add tags, add recipients if you want. So when I think about private data, that is not something that you want to go wide. So why would I use a protocol to store that information when, you know, it's made to do exactly the opposite thing? Now, letting somebody know that something exists but doesn't, but not you know, making it discoverable and saying, yeah, okay, this information is actually available, but there are certain conditions or hoops you're gonna have to jump through to get access to that. You know, primarily it's usually, you know, the user's permission to give you that data. Then it makes sense to advertise that it exists in some kind of event, like a badge or whatever it is, but actually not use relays to store that data. And I wouldn't even use private relays to store that data, because, you know, once a client has an event, there's nothing that stops them from publishing that event to other relays, right?
So yeah. Have you looked into NIP17 DMs at all?
Not recently. Can you refresh my memory?
Yeah. So when we last talked, it was all kind of in draft format, but it's got some adoption now. NIP17 DMs are, you know, a specific application of NIP59, which is event wrapping. And that, I think, it solves some of these problems, although there are other trade-offs, like not being able to know what kind of events you're requesting after you decrypt them. But the way it basically works is you create an event, but you don't sign it. And then you encrypt that event to a given public key, and then you put that in another event called the seal, and you do sign that one. And then you encrypt that event and you put that in a wrap. And the wrapper, you sign with a ephemeral key, and then you address it to someone. And what that does is if someone sees the wrapper, all they know is the person it's addressed to and not the person who signed it. And then if you publicize the seal, you only know who signed it, but not who it's to. And then if you publicize the rumor on the inside, you know the content of the message, but you have deniability. And it's going to be rejected from a lot of relays. Does that kind of like solve some of those problems for you, or is that, you know, kind of an incomplete solution?
So again, bearing in mind that trying to keep things as simple as possible, I do remember reading through that NIP at some point. And like I say, I'm not the best developer in the world. And if it's confusing to me, then how easy is that going to be to adopt for other developers who want to make use of this? And then when you have complexity, you know, things can go wrong pretty quickly. To my mind, it's a solution that's complicated because you started with the wrong tool to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're trying to fit private data into a broadcast mode, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that's a fair criticism. I think the good thing about it is that it's stateless. So there's no interactivity required in a protocol in order to keep things secret. Whereas if you look at like SimpleX or Signal, you have all this like ratchet state that has to be stored in certain places. And if you leak nonces then or reuse nonces, then you're in a lot of trouble. So like in my opinion, I think NIP 59 is actually a lot simpler than these other solutions just because they require so much state and negotiation. But you're right that like, you know, the non-interactive simplicity can only go so far because, of course, you can correlate these messages on relays by doing IP monitoring and, you know, so correlating identity on different levels. But it's trade-offs all the way down, of course. And like the biggest problem I've had with this so far is that, you know, you don't necessarily know what kind of content you're downloading. It might be a DM. It might be a group message. It might be a note that you sent to yourself with settings in it or something like that. Yeah. And so it kind of forces clients to download the entire universe in order to know just one piece of data. So yeah, there's definitely downsides to it, but at least it's a step forward. Jeff G is looking into MLS, implementing MLS in a Nostr compatible way. And I think that's very promising because it supports one-to-one messaging as well as larger groups in a fairly performant way. And using a pretty well-tested cryptography scheme, but I kind of think that a lot of this this identity-based stuff would require either an interactive protocol or some really like extra fancy cryptography in order to really pull off. My sense is that you know you want to keep your data to yourself, put it on a server, maybe don't even sign it, but just have it available, and then you authenticate people who ask for it. Or you, you know, if they request it, then you can deliver it to them. But, you know, the complexity that introduces is, you know, your bank wants to ask, you know, are you, what's your credit rating? And then they ask your credit rating identity provider, or maybe they ask you. And then you have this attestation from your credit agency that that you don't publish because you don't want everyone to know your credit score. And then you send that to your bank and now the bank knows. But that kind of like that has the same problem that the Lightning Network has where you have to be online in order to send or receive. Have you thought about solving those problems at all? Or is that kind of like still out of scope from where you're working?
Yeah, so I decided to not worry about it at the moment. But to reinforce your point, before I discovered Nostr, I played around a lot with Microsoft's implementation of verifiable credentials. So that interactivity part is really, really, it's really high friction for a user where, you know, you have to download the Microsoft Authenticator app where they shoehorned in this approval process. And then when you're doing something online and then you have to go over here to the app to like approve somebody's request for it. And I played around with it and I reached the point where it's like, well, maybe this can mature, but if you're having to insert a user into a process every time, it's bad UX and it's not really scalable. So I don't know exactly what that solution should be, but I wasn't really happy with the status quo of where we're at with that. So
yeah, maybe different use cases deserve different approaches though. Cause like, you know, for the I'm not a robot piece of data, like there's not really any reason not to publish that. Like showing that you're not a robot is really useful to a lot of people and does not reveal anything about you, basically.
Yeah. So this is where I get excited when we talk about, okay, well, what's the use of pseudonymous or reputational data versus PII, right? So again, bringing it back to the real world, like if you meet somebody new for the first time at a party or an event, right? What kind of questions do you ask? Is your first question, hey, what's your name, address, and phone number and date of birth? No, that's not the first
thing. Mine is.
But
got to KYC all my friends,
right? But the way applications work today, that's basically what it is, right? It's like, okay, here is like the generic storefront page, and before we have any type of relationship that goes beyond what everybody else gets, I'm immediately going to ask you for your PII, right? That's, you know, a reflection of the fact that, you know, the internet protocols are designed to be anonymous, and then we, you know, shoehorn these things on top, and things like email address and phone number are great as like unique identifiers, but shouldn't be asking for those things until you get a little bit farther along in the relationship, right? So what's interesting to me, what I did as an experiment is go to like the Amazon.com like homepage, and then, you know, log in as yourself. Almost all of us have bought something from Amazon at some point, and then just go to their homepage and see how engaging the content is. Then if you got a VPN, use a VPN, go put yourself in a different city, go in incognito mode and load up that same page, and it sucks. Like, so there's a lot of benefit for the individual in terms of user experience if they're willing to share some information. But I think the most people are like, I don't mind you knowing, you know, some things about me to give me a better experience, but the last thing I want to do is receive phone calls from you or get spam email or, you know, all of these other things. So I think there's a middle ground getting to know you bunch of use cases for AKA profiles where you have NIM data that helps an application or even like it's someone you're potentially connecting to the first time know something about you, but you don't fully trust them yet to give them your actual email address or phone number or whatever it is.
Yeah, definitely. And that is a super good point that like sometimes it is in your benefit to give your data to two companies so they can give you a better experience. One company that is doing interesting work in this area is Lunch Money. It's at getlunchmoney.com. And they're basically, they give you a browser extension that sites can integrate that asks the user, hey, like, I would like to show you personalized recommendations. Do you want to tell me this and this and this about yourself? And then you can either approve or deny it and kind of tailor your experience and privacy level depending on the site in a really granular way. And they also pay you for it. So instead of it just being a chore, you actually get paid to share your data, which is a pretty cool idea. I'm not sure if it's like a complete solution. And it does have that friction aspect to it that you mentioned. But like sometimes that friction is probably warranted. So like, you know, like I was saying before, if you just publish that you're not a robot publicly, that's fine data to have about you. It's not super sensitive, but other more sensitive things like your social security number or something, you don't want to just like public or just the fact that you're a US citizen or something. You don't want to publish that completely publicly. And if someone is asking you for that data, you probably do want to specifically approve it. So like if you had an AMBER sort of situation where, you know, someone could send you a request for data to your PubKey and you open up the app on your phone and you say, you know, it says PubKey A has requested this attestation from you. Do you want to approve or deny? and then you just like approve or deny on your phone. That could be a good experience. And like, it does the same thing to identity requests that Bitcoin does to payments. Because with the legacy financial system with cards, the default is you do pay someone. So if someone steals your card information, they can just charge you. Or if you have an active subscription, it's on until you actively turn it off. And like, you know, bank statements are so obscure. I have a subscription, at least one right now, that I get charged like $5 a month. And I think it's something I bought that I want, but I have no idea what it is. It's just completely obscure to me. Whereas with Bitcoin, you know, if you have an active subscription, that subscription is managed by some piece of software. And so you just go into the software, whatever you're using, whether it's your node or hosted or something, and you just say, like, cancel that subscription. You don't have to go and navigate Amazon's extremely user-hostile process for canceling Amazon Prime. You just revoke permission to payments. And if you could do the same thing with your identity, I think that could be a really... Well, I mean, I guess identity does currently work like that in legacy world. Like, if you want to do a loan and you have a credit freeze, then you have to unfreeze your credit. But, like, the whole system...
Yeah, but you don't have any control over that. You're basically asking / begging a company to own your information to do something on your behalf, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so when I think about concepts, I like to think about the extremes to see, you know, what might be interesting in the middle ground. So, you know, on one extreme, if you don't want anybody to know anything about you, you know, you can do a whole bunch of stuff, right? You can use a VPN, you can use a Tor network, you can, you know, do X, Y, and Z. But, and you can, for most people, it's just basically turning on incognito mode in your browser. Now, being technical, we know that's not truly incognito, but, you know, for most people, that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
But just as a thought experiment, what would happen if you had the opposite of incognito mode, which is like, this is everything that I want to share about myself, and it's on all the time, right? How does that change the experience? First, thinking from like an optimistic point of view, right? So let's say I'm in anti-incognito mode, and it's got maybe not my home address, but it knows I'm in Vancouver. So, it knows my city. It knows I'm male. It knows my clothing sizes. You know, it knows maybe my profession, whatever it is. And then I go to like a clothing retailer site, right? If that's all shared automatically under the hood, now, okay, privacy warnings flashing, but anyway, just ignore it for now. Yeah. Then in terms of the experience I get, it's like it can actually show me everything that it can figure out immediately on the first page, right? Like that's a pretty cool experience. So then it goes to that old trade-off again for people. It's like, how much are you going to value like convenience over privacy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
Yeah, and what Nostr can do to take that even farther, that trade-off even farther, is to link in your social graph so that, you know, when you're doing something, you're not only sharing who you are, but you're also, in a way, sharing who other people in your social graph are. Because if you can say, like, show me book suggestions or something by the three pub keys that I trust to recommend books, then you get even better, more tailored recommendations, because it's not based on, like, content analysis or traffic analysis. It's based on like explicit trust attestations about a given topic. Like, that would be a user experience that I would really enjoy, but it would also, you know, leak even more data to the world about yourself.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is what you're describing already accidentally exists because, you know, I'm in a household with my wife and my kid. We have the same IP address. And you know, sometimes on these different platforms, I'll get ads which I know are targeted to her. She'll get ads she knows are targeted to me.
Yeah.
It's quite funny.
Yeah, that's totally true. Cool. So let's see. Have we covered communities and that kind of thing?
No, and I, actually, this is one of the things I wanted to ask you about, right? So I know in Coracle, you implemented the idea of like private groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I, in other traditional social media apps, you have the same idea as well. Like you can have a Facebook group, you can have, you know, a sub-channel on Reddit, this type of thing. But, you know, at the same time, you could... Assuming like the messages don't need to be kept completely private, at the same time in a feed, if you just filtered by a badge that defines a group, isn't that kind of the same thing? So like, where's the dividing line between, you know, like a feed versus like an open group?
Yeah, well, that's kind of how NIP72 communities work already. That's the open groups. You publish to the group, and you can publish to a group even if you're not a member of it, and then you self-select into or out of the group. So it's a very like loose, open structure, kind of like Reddit. And of course, NIP29 groups add some interesting aspects to that. But you know, and NIP29 groups allow for authentication and gating based on which relay that you're working off of. So
yeah,
so there is a little bit more exclusivity possible in that version. But yeah, like NIP72 isn't based on badges, and so the control of who is in the group is, well, it's kind of default open, and then you have moderation, so you can kick people out. So it's sort of the opposite from badges. But I like the idea of awarding and then revoking badges, and that's kind of how the NIP, 86 or whatever my private group's NIP is. It hasn't been merged or anything yet, so
yeah.
It has a provisional number, but. The way that one works is everything is encrypted, and you may or may not actually publish even the group metadata publicly. So you can have it all pretty much private. And so because it's private, obviously you have to invite people. And so what you do is you send a shared key, and that if you have the shared key, you necessarily have access to the group because you can then request those events and decrypt them. And then so if you want to revoke access to a group, you have to rotate the key and get everyone else to start publishing with the new key.
Yeah.
So you have a lot kind of like harder constraints as far as group access. And if you lose your admin key, you can't rotate keys anymore and you're kind of out of luck. So yeah, those are two extremes. A badge-based group is interesting because it would give the admin or the moderator or whoever the ability to shape the membership. But then you would also have kind of an open group where anyone can read, but only certain people can write.
Yeah, I think I did look through NIP72. It seemed to be focused on like moderation capabilities more than anything else. But hearkening back to an early part of our conversation, I don't know if you necessarily need to use the Nostr protocol if you're doing a private group, given that the information isn't meant to go wide, but you know, if the technology exists and you want to reuse your same pub key in it, then yeah, you can just set up a private relay and it makes sense. But I think in terms of how Nostr does things differently, the idea of like open groups is interesting, and then the idea of, you know, can you automate or make obsolete this idea of moderation if you have, you know, more data that's centralized to a pub key that's available to these applications that are deciding what to show and what to hide, right? If we go back to Web of Trust a little bit as well, I haven't seen a lot of people on the Nostr Telegram group talking about engagement rates, which comes from traditional social media companies. So for instance, if you have somebody who's like spamming a group, you know, one solution is you have like the moderator like ban them or mute them, you know, but the other solution is to calculate their engagement rate and then say, okay, if the total engagement, whether it's measured in likes or comments, whatever you like, you know, divided by the number of people that are receiving it is lower than a certain, you know, percentage, then this message is like hidden automatically, right?
Interesting. Yeah, a lot of stuff there. I think engagement is something that people don't talk about a lot on Nostr because it is so closely tied to, you know, making a business case for features insofar as it gets you eyeballs to put on advertisements. So there's, for a good reason, a lot of skepticism about engagement. Engagement also, you know, it's coercing people or persuading people to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do with their precious time. And, you know, Nostr pulls in two different directions, right? You've got the people who want to grow Nostr, and that's engagement through memes and entertainment and stuff like that. And then on the other side, there's kind of like, well, maybe social media should have less of a role in our lives. And so how do you make a social media platform work if you don't optimize for engagement? And how do you fight against the platforms that do, that are more addictive? And I don't know if there's a way to solve that problem, but I do like the way you're thinking about moderation based on some metric, whether it's engagement or whether it's you know, how tied into an in-group you are. I've you know, even before I found Nostr, I've been thinking about decentralized moderation to where, you know, even you've got plenty of social signals. If you have up and down votes, like on Reddit, it would be trivial to just hide stuff that's downvoted or bury it at the bottom. And that's basically decentralized moderation. You don't need a mod with an iron fist, you know, sort of sorting things out. And that is my main problem with NIP72 is the moderation model that that is in that NIP is way too strict. And so basically content is opt in only after it's been approved by a moderator. Even though it's public, clients could show unapproved posts. Right now, most of them only show moderated posts, and then moderators are just trying things out, so they're not highly engaged, and the subreddit or the group eventually just dies because no posts are getting approved, including replies. And so I think it has stifled the use of groups. My implementation in Coracle just doesn't do moderation at all, which I think is preferable to that model. But I do want to add in moderation of the kind that we're talking about at some point, where it's like, we'll take the social signals and make it mostly good for the particular user we're serving, rather than, you know, having this really rigid model instead.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying about like engagement kind of being a dirty word, but the way I'm using it is just the strict like definition of like engagement rate, right?
So
total engagement divided by either total audience, total members of the audience, or total posts, just as a rate. The reason I've been thinking about it is it's interesting because you can modify the engagement rate, the numerator, the engagement, by, you know, people who are similar to you, based on badges, based off of, you know, other attributes.
Yeah, Fullograph, content analysis, anything really.
Yeah, because then you're getting like a very personalized engagement rate based off of this person, and then you get an even more tailored experience in terms of, you know, what shows up in your feed. So I don't know. I'm surprised. Maybe it's just because people don't like the negative connotations with anything to do with traditional social media, but it seems like a reasonable thing to do. And then the other part I would say is that a lot of the things that social media platforms do today to keep people's attention is because they are based off the advertising model, right? You have to keep people actively using the platform and spending more time than they intended. So then they probably skew the engagement rate where anything that has a high engagement rate, whether it's positive or negative, they're going to promote. Because if you get angry, you're going to sit there and start replying back. You're like, you're an idiot. There's a blah, 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 right? And then they can show you ads while you rage. So,
yeah, that's a good point. Like if you're doing this to serve the user and to provide content that is what they want to see, then what the nature of that content is totally up to the user. Maybe they want to be mad and you can serve them that content. But, you know, most people are not trying to opt into that unless they're bringing their bad habits from other social media platforms. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, if you're optimizing for engagement for the sake of increasing engagement in a positive way, in a healthy way, for what the user is actually there for, that can make a lot more sense.
Yeah, you know, engagement rate as a predictor of if someone's actually going to find this content interesting or not, right? And then focusing on having both like a positive engagement rate and a negative engagement rate.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and you know, the measure, you optimize what you measure. And so if you're measuring for engagement, you're going to optimize for it. But in this system, it sounds like, you know, there's no particular value associated with a higher engagement level. It's just that, well, if they are engaged, as long as they're engaging, I'm going to give them something that they don't regret engaging with, you know, and then, you know, trust them to be done when the time comes. You know, I think it's interesting. A really interesting part of the whole Nostr project is reclaiming a lot of these sort of dystopian concepts from the legacy world. You know, we're talking about engagement, advertising, KYC, and then there was one other. Oh, trust and safety is another concept that I've worked on a little bit. You know, we're talking about reports and stuff like that. We don't have to get into that one in particular, but you know, there's a lot of this.
To clarify, on your previous podcast, you were talking about reports, and I literally thought you were creating like a report, like a management dashboard report.
Oh,
and it took me a while to realize, oh, you mean what one user is reporting on the bad behavior of another user. But yeah, that wasn't immediately obvious to me.
Yeah, I know. I've had that same thought too. It's confusing to figure out how to frame it when you're like writing code. You know, is report a verb or a noun? It can get kind of confusing.
Yeah.
But yeah, like there's all these dystopian sort of Orwellian terms that are out there, like trust and safety. You know, that sounds like a pretty Orwellian term, but if you think about it, well, it's just describing, you know, who is trusted and, you know, by whom. And then safety is protecting people from harm, however you might define that. And you can define it like a leftist, or you can just, you know, you can define it other ways. And so these dystopian terms are that because of the cultural context, but they don't represent useless ideas. And this is something that I am cautiously optimistic about Nostr doing, is reclaiming these terms. So, you know, talking about KYC, right? KYC is an idea that was sort of invented in, what, the 70s or something, when the KYC anti-money laundering laws came in.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, and so it has this historical context of, well, we're trying to stop the bad guys, and in the process of doing that, we're going to just roll over the Bill of Rights. And that's obviously like a bad thing, and we should be fighting that, resisting that. But knowing your customer is something that's been done throughout human history. In a lot of cases, it was done organically. Like, I know the miller, and I have to have a good relationship with him, because if I get in a fight with him, he's not going to mill my grain, and I'm going to be up the creek. And then I'll have to, like, sell my grain unmilled to someone else and lose some profit. And so, like, KYC is a really important aspect of human society, just like trust is, just like safety is. And being able to reframe these terms in a way that is defined by, you know, I guess the combination of the user's individual values as like a consumer and as a producer of content and information and goods, combined with community values, whether you're talking about community in the small scale or society as a whole, like those are like helpful and productive things. And if we just don't have a framework for thinking about these things at all, we're going to fall into the default, whatever that might be, whether importing from the legacy system or doing the exact opposite, and things are not going to work as well. So I appreciate that you're thinking about these things, even if it sounds a little bit scary sometimes.
Yeah, you know, I just like people from the Bitcoin space, it's not just technology we're building. We have ideas of, I don't know what you call them, principles, the first principles as we build stuff. For me personally, other than really horrific hate speech where you're literally calling for the killing of other people, I really do believe that people have a right to say whatever they want to say, especially if it goes against what's considered, you know, common wisdom of the society of the day. But at the same time, individuals also have the right not to view that information if they don't want to, right? So for me, in terms of Nostr technology, I definitely lean more towards filters that you can turn off if you want, but not outright banning of content or deleting of content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so how would you think about badges in this way of kind of like, you know, rejecting the dystopian frame that we sort of swim in and reclaiming the terms KYC and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, in terms of badges and content promotion / filtering, which is actually the same thing, I do like to be a product that's different than what currently exists. I do like the idea of starting sort of more local or personal in scope, and then being able to expand out from there, right? So people you directly follow, that makes a lot of sense, right? And then beyond that, people from your immediate community. So I know it's called Thank God for Nostr. I'm not a member of a church, but that's like, you know, your family and then your friends and then your community. And then, you know, one level sort of out from that, maybe not at a church level, but I don't know the term for it, but when you have multiple churches associated with the same branch of the same religion would be part of like your larger community again, right? So, you know, filling up your feed from the center and then moving outwards, I think makes a lot of sense to me. And so, you know, if you have a member of, say, your community that's acting badly, you probably should know about that, right? But if you just have some random stranger acting badly and you know, putting bad content, you don't need to see that, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's a good distinction. That's pretty helpful. Yeah, and then, like, as far as, well, like, so much of KYC is embedded in this legacy fiat system of debt and centralized control and government intrusion into personal privacy and all that kind of thing. You know, and that's in a lot of ways not a system that I'm interested in rebuilding.
Yeah.
I am interested in institutions that make the good things about that possible. But, you know, being able to be sovereign over your data and selective about who gets to know you and who gets access to your private data is a really good thing. And like,
yeah,
there's
a bigger issue here as well that's very important, which is that for some people, they cannot actually be themselves online unless they're anonymous, which is weird to say, or pseudo-anonymous. But, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of places in the world where if you don't fit the societal norm, you are heavily discriminated against. Actually, there's even a case here locally. I was talking with a guy who really nice guy, and he worked with children in sort of a boys and girls club. And he was saying that, you know, personally, his views are much more conservative rather than liberal. But if he ever posted his actual views online under his name, he knows he would get fired immediately, right? Like,
yeah.
So it's like for him to be his authentic self online, he can't be identifiable because it would literally cost him his job, right? Or you talk about different minority groups or people who would get discriminated against. So it's really important for people to live fulfilling online lives, to have systems where they can interact, they can have reputation, but not be identifiable.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting problem and question. And there seems to be, on like the conservative side of the political aisle, a swing back to or maybe not back to, but a swing towards not appreciating or valuing anonymity, which is pretty concerning. And I kind of like chalk this up to the Jordan Peterson, Elon Musk sort of effect, where it's in their interest, or at least Musk's interest, to be able to know the details of the people who are using Twitter so that he can, you know, do payments and take something off the top and stuff like that. But, you know, there's so much heritage in the American story that is involved with anonymity. Like, You've got the Federalist Papers were written anonymously. You got Common Sense by Thomas Paine, which was released anonymously.
Yeah.
And there's like a huge, there is a really big place for anonymity in especially like political discourse or journalism. But like what a lot of Christians I talk to sort of say about anonymity is it undermines authenticity, right? Where you end up being a different person online than in real life. And because they're not connected, you're not accountable to the community that you're a part of in real life. And so your online persona drifts farther from your real life persona until there's a break and you go one way or the other. And usually the online persona is kind of the beginning of your moving out of your structures of community, family, accountability. And like, I agree with that concern. That's a real concern. But, you know, you mentioned authenticity where, you know, you can't act authentically online unless you are anonymous. And the idealist in me really wants to say, well, deal with it and be anonymous and not be anonymous and be authentic.
Yep.
You know, because like we saw this with COVID where a lot of people went ahead and got the vaccine because they didn't want to get fired from their job. And the effect of that was that there were very few people actually making a stink about, you know, the United States and companies violating the Nuremberg Code. If these people had said, okay, I will lose my job, and you had 30 million people losing their job over this coerced medical thing, like maybe things would have resolved a lot more quickly. And I guess we've sort of gotten through it anyway, but I would have seen that as salutary. But of course, these people were afraid of not being able to provide for their families. So all I'm saying, I don't know what the right answer is or if there is a right answer, but like it really depends on your risk profile, whether the right thing to do is to be authentic and have integrity across your different identities and circumstances, or whether the best idea is to divorce your one identity from another.
I think a lot of people's opinions on it are based off of their personal experience. If you've never been a member of a persecuted group, you probably are more likely, unless you're very intellectual about it, you're probably more likely to lean towards everyone should be their authentic selves online. If you've ever been a subject of discrimination, it's like, no, sometimes being out of the high parts of who you are makes a lot of sense, right?
So. Yeah, no, that's a super good point. Having that experience, because being discriminated against is way worse than it sounds like. I've not really experienced that. I've had some small tastes of that, and it is it's extremely difficult, very offensive, very angering to be on the receiving end of that. So, yeah, for sure.
Especially if you just want to talk about like hardware, computer hardware, and stuff there. Why are you attacking me personally? I just want to talk about like CPUs, right? It's ridiculous sometimes.
Yeah, and it is like having those anonymity tools is necessary to have many kinds of free speech. And so like, you know, regardless of whether it's a good idea for an individual person to choose to be anonymous or not, like those are definitely things that we should ensure are available to people if they need them.
Yeah. Anyway, there's one other thing I want to talk about, going all the way back to AKA profiles and badges.
Yeah.
What I did was, logically within the application, like there's the idea of groups and badges, where a group is like a membership into a group. And then when you define a group in AKA profiles, you choose one or more badges that must be awarded before you get awarded membership to the group, right? So let's say you wanted to have some kind of application or whatever it is only for people who are not a robots and like in a specific country as an example, right? So let's say, okay, let's choose the not a bot badge, and let's choose the IP to geolocation badge, you know, for Canada or the US or whatever country it is. And then I'll create a group requiring these two badges, and then a user has to have those two badges awarded before my application grants them access to the group. What was interesting is that the group is, as a logical concept, is really just another badge. You're just identifying, you're just associating a piece of information with an individual. So what I did was, with my additional tags to NIP58, when you're defining a badge, you can also add one or more A tags. I think they're A tags, which then defines like the list of other badges that are required as the eligibility requirement for this badge. And then I just called that a group. But what's interesting about it is you can start to see that there's this like hierarchy of information that builds up, where you start at the lowest level that defines a particular group, and then that group membership can be a requirement to be a member like of a larger group with even more people. So I thought that was interesting. I debated for a long time about should this be like a different kind or not. It's like, well, no, if it fits within like the current event, and I'm adding tags, I'm not repurposing tags, I think I'll do it that way. So that was interesting.
Yeah, so those badges, those could be rewarded or awarded directly to people bypassing those prerequisites. But I guess if those other badges that are prerequisites are already rewarded, clients can basically infer that that badge has been automatically awarded. Is that kind of the idea?
Okay. Yeah, right. So you click a button to apply for a group. It checks. It says, hey, this person already has all the required badges. I can just immediately issue them a badge, which is really the group, and then like they're into the application, and they didn't have to do anything from a user point of view.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm not totally sure what I think about that, but it is an interesting way to look at it. Another way to look at badges too is like badges are replaceable events, right? And so you've got a pub key, which is static, but you also have a D tag on the badge, which is kind of the identifier. And you know, for a lot of these like KYC type of identity verification or authentication sort of use cases, you don't want to pin the identity to a particular provider necessarily. There might be multiple providers that you trust to make that attestation, and so you could have multiple badges listed that satisfy a particular condition. Maybe that's what you're talking about, where these preconditions can be anded together or they can be ored together. But you know, you could also just target a D tag too and say like anyone can make this attestation. And like it doesn't really mean that much at that point, but you could say like if anyone is awarded a badge with this D tag, regardless of what pub key it's from, like that's good enough for some use case. So
yeah, that actually brings up another point, right? So that could be pretty easily abused if somebody wanted to. I was toying around with the idea. I almost need like a general attestation event, a new kind, where all it is my application would have a private key that can publish the event ID and signature, another event, to attest that, yes, this did actually run through my system. So if you trust me in my system, you can verify that you can trust that this information is true, right? It's an interesting one, but it's almost like the secondary level of attestation that somebody can verify, right? Because otherwise, if you don't really trust an event, then you have to do a bunch of stuff to, you know, check the signature and the rest of it. You're not really sure if you can trust the timestamp that they created at on the event. So something I was toying around with.
Yeah, second order trust. That is interesting. Have you looked at NIP77 at all? There's been a decent amount of conversation on this in the last 2-3 months.
I haven't. You want to give me the short story here?
Yeah, it's basically a NIP for expressing trust in a context. So it's got context, it's got score and confidence. So you might say, I want to attest that this person is good at economics, but I don't know economics very well, so I'm going to set my confidence really low. And what it is, it's basically like a general purpose framework for expressing trust between people with context involved. And like that leads into all kinds of problems, like, you know, how do you establish a vocabulary that actually works for expressing contexts, But kind of setting that aside, that could be a good option for that second order trust attestation you're talking about, or maybe some of these other use cases.
Yeah, it's been a couple of months, but I do remember reading some nips in draft exactly about this. I put some comments there at the time, but I don't remember what they are now. But the problem space is too big to formalize the nip on that, in my opinion. I think that someone with a particular use case should just use one of like the application kind events. So, you know, you're putting a rating on a food product or restaurant or whatever it is. And a couple other people would be doing the same thing. And then you'd look at what are the real world commonalities between how these things are used. Does it make sense to centralize it in a NIP, or are the use cases actually so different and the tags so different that they should just live as different kinds?
Yeah, I think that's a super good point. You know, I published a NIP for reviews a while ago. I don't think it's been merged, but I use it for doing reviews of relays. So you can tell, you know, is this defunct or do they censor stuff or whatever it might be.
Yep.
And, you know, a review is a review. And you can get really granular. You could even say like a review of one thing, a review of like toothpaste is different from a review of a movie. And it has different attributes. So like getting pretty granular and not overloading kinds in Nostr is probably a good thing. I think there's probably still a place for this NIP77 stuff because it is kind of like pub key to pub key relationships. But
yeah,
but you're probably right that like looking really granularly at the rest of the kinds and the events that are out there and inferring trust from that is a better way to go. I talked to David, who's been working on this NIP just recently on the podcast, and that'll come out in a little while. For listeners, it will already have come out. And we talk about that a lot. And I like a lot of his ideas for approaching it. It's less rigid than you might expect in the first place. But yeah, I think there's a balance between these two approaches.
Yeah, and you know, and in general, like no one's really formalized what the best practices are around NIPs. But you know, I assume that any application can add additional tags when they publish an event based off of a NIP, as long as they're not overriding the meaning of any of the tags that are explicitly defined in the NIP. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, maybe getting a little crazier, clients can do whatever they want regardless of what is in the NIP because it's a permissionless protocol. And so if clients aren't hardened against maliciously crafted events, then you know, they're broken basically. So yeah, I think you can do pretty much whatever you want. The risk is that someone with a lot of adoption comes in and does something incompatible. But yeah,
yeah.
The extra tags thing, there are probably better ways to do that in a lot of cases. But I don't see a lot of problems with adding an extra tag or two here and there.
Yeah.
Like the badges hierarchy stuff, I mean, it definitely doesn't break compatibility. You might not get expected behavior in clients that don't support the hierarchy stuff, but then it also sounds fairly special purpose, and so it could be safely ignored without any loss of user experience. So, yeah, it's hard to tell. You kind of got to go at it on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. Can I ask you another question? What do you do with, like, kind zero replaceable events, right? Because, you know, those can get like overloaded pretty quickly, and you don't want to necessarily like delete information that someone's put in there, but that information may not necessarily be specified in a NIP anywhere. Do you like load it all up, make the change you make, and then save the whole thing back?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think best practice, and this is something that came from JB55, is to try to avoid stomping any tags that are there. So, you know, for example, mute lists or follow lists, people have stuck T tags into those. And until recently, when you followed someone on Coracle, it would remove all the T tags from your list because I would read the event, put it into a proprietary format that ignores T tags, and then I would write it back to the event and publish that. But I am slowly working on changing to a new architecture, and it is like a really a re-architecture of keeping the event as kind of a proof for every domain specific object that I have. So I'll still create the profile, but I'll have an event in there. And then when I edit the profile, I still have all the tags on the event, and then I can modify the tags as needed. And there are still some assumptions that you have to make, like, do you remove, you're adding images, are you going to replace all the images, or are you going to add and deduplicate, or like, what is the operation you do? But it does make things a lot safer. On kind zeros, adding extra fields, I think, is completely fine. They may get stomped by some clients, but I think clients are generally pretty good about kind zeros.
Yeah, I took the, I don't know if it's going to be a problem, but I took the easy approach where I literally just used the NDK, the Noster Development Kit.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have, like, convenience functions for obtaining profiles. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the guys who work on that are generally aware of what's going on. So if they decided to, like, ignore a tag and it gets lost on the update, it's like, well, I'm going to consider this compatible with NDK, if nothing else.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a safe way to go, for sure.
Yeah, you know, like, replaceable events, they're tricky. I don't know if that's the case where you want to have the idea of publishing diffs as opposed to just republishing the entire event, and so clients have a better opportunity to, like, fix things if they go wrong.
Yeah, I'm anti-replaceable events, but the ship has sailed, and it's become an idiom in Noster. And the problem with them is that they destroy information. So, you know, people are talking about deleting replaceable events by replacing the replaceable event with empty information rather than deleting. I just don't think there's a lot of benefit to that. And when you do update an event, you don't have that diff in every case. And so, you know, it's just hard to tell what actually happened. And that's true of a lot of different use cases. But replaceables are kind of becoming a lot more standard than one-off events. And it just kind of is what it is. I know Semisoul and Will at one point updated the Domus relay to keep all the versions of replaceables and serve them all. I'm not sure if that's still the case, so that clients can reconcile diffs. Because, like, the follow list race condition is an example of that.
Yeah,
right? You know, you're persisting the entire list every time, and so maybe a new follow gets lost, or maybe something gets followed twice, and so you have to trace the history of it, and that's not a trivial thing, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a good time to wrap up. We've been going for an hour and a half now.
Oh my goodness!
And I appreciate you coming on. I really appreciate your thoughts on this whole topic. Definitely has given me some food for thought, and I think has sharpened my own thoughts about this whole topic. So definitely enjoyed our conversation. And is there anything that you want to leave people with?
Yeah, it's I'm still in beta. So there's no guarantee the data you create today is going to be available tomorrow. But I am interested in connecting with other developers who have a use case around badges, but don't want to have to write a whole bunch of badge code themselves. The documentation and a link to the app is all on akaprofiles.com, or you can find me on Noster. You can publish my pub key with this podcast.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'd reach out because I'm getting close, and I'd really like to start integrating with some Noster applications to inform the roadmap for the continued development of AKA Profiles.
Yeah, and I would definitely be interested in doing that too. I think having something to allow new users to overcome the kind of zero web of trust bootstrapping problem would be worth having around. So that's the main use case that I'm thinking of.
Okay, yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Neil. I will keep in touch with you on Noster. And we'll see you all on Noster.
Yeah, great chat. Thanks.